The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Hey, Miriam.
Yes, Doug.
Well, it's another podcast. It's the Zero Books podcast.
Hooray!
In this episode, I interview Ralph Leonard. I actually recorded this as a video. So people who sign up for Patreon can watch this as well as listen to it. But Ralph Leonard and I discuss C.L.R. James in this podcast. They can look for Ralph Leonard on Medium. And in the future, he's going to write a book for us. He's going to write a book for Zero Books. He says he's going to turn one in October.
That's wonderful.
Anyway, it's what, August 27th, 2020. I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. And the music you're listening to right now, what music should we run? Come on.
You know better than that.
The Entertainer. It's The Entertainer.
Easy.
By Scott Joplin. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ralph Leonard and I to talk about C.L.R. James. Ralph Leonard is a returning guest on the Zero Books podcast. He is a British-Nigerian writer on international politics, religion, culture, and humanism, and is specifically the author of the essay C.L.R. James Rejected the Posturing of Identity Politics, which I think we've discussed before. We'll be returning to James and to the Haitian Revolution in today's conversation. So, Ralph Leonard, thanks for coming back onto the Zero Books YouTube channel and podcast.
Thank you for asking me.
Yeah. So I wanted to start with that essay again. The C.L.R. James Rejected the Posturing of Identity Politics, specifically because in that essay you wrote that the French started in 1789, the Haitians completed in 1804. And I wondered, what was it that was completed in Haiti, do you think? Or to put it differently, what is the relationship between bourgeois revolutions, the kind of bourgeois revolutions we saw in the late 18th and 19th century, the early 19th century, or throughout, I guess, really the 19th century, and whatever struggle for socialism might still exist today?
Well, speaking to the relationship between the French Revolution and the Haitian Revolution is that, well, it's very simple. The slogan of the great French Revolution, as it's often been termed, you know, liberty, equality, fraternity, was proclaimed, but it wasn't always enforced or actualized equally across skin pigmentation. So it was liberty for white people, but, you know, not for enslaved black people. Because what you have to understand is that throughout that sort of era, like, the metaphor of slavery was used very frequently. So, for example, the American revolutionaries always talked about their colonial link with Britain as a form of slavery. And you also see this throughout many Enlightenment philosophers, yet actual slavery of plantation slavery was very seldom discussed in this way. And in my opinion, the Haitian Revolution basically took that slogan of liberty and pushed it to its logical conclusion. Because if there's such a thing as universal humanity and universal rights of man, then surely they apply to enslaved black people as much as to free white people, and those mm-hmm. enslaved black people deserve to be free.
Right. I guess my question is, to what extent that even after you overcome actual slavery, is the aim of bourgeois freedom achieved? You know, to what extent do we really have equality, for instance, even after? I mean, obviously you don't have equality if you live in a world that depends upon slavery as its economic foundation, which is really interesting to consider. It's really interesting to consider to the degree to which Haiti in particular was important to developing the bourgeois power that led to the French Revolution. So, you have this call for freedom coming out of slavery and massive oppression and exploitation, but not like, not directly until maybe the Haitian Revolution itself. I'm wondering, when you think about the struggle for socialism, which I think of as at least in line with or development upon the kinds of values that were espoused by Enlightenment thinkers and the bourgeois thinkers. When you think about the struggle for socialism, did Haiti achieve, because when you think about completing the bourgeois revolutions, I think socialism is what it would take to complete those revolutions. So was the Haitian Revolution a completion in that sense, or does it have something to tell us as we try to achieve that kind of completion?
Well, I wouldn't say it completed the bourgeois revolutions because, because ultimately I don't think you can have freedom in the complete sense without transcending class society, which means, transcending capitalism itself. Because what the Haitian Revolution, and as well as the French and the American Revolutions, came about in a very sort of unique period, where you saw the decline of feudalism, the rise of the bourgeoisie as a class, and rapid urbanization and free wage labor, free wage or so-called free wage labor, superseding more caste and custom-based forms of social organization. And it's also in that period where various philosophers sort of noted the ideas of freedom, a very unique idea of freedom, which is linked to the development of human powers in accordance to sort of the massive social and economic forces that was growing and developing around them. And Marxism comes into this because it sort of looks at how these structural changes and human agency interact with one another, how these structural forces either enhance or constrain human agency, or actually do both, because Marxism is all about noting contradictions. So I think that, and I actually agree with you that socialism, in a way, is both the negation of bourgeois society, but it's also its accomplishment. It's sort of it's transcending it, it's canceling it, but transcending it as well. It's fulfilling it as well as in its transcendation. So that's where I think the relationship comes into it.
Well, to speak specifically about the Haitian Revolution and how we might think of, but maybe the way I'll frame this is this way. When we think about what happened in Haiti and how revolutionary forces came together in Haiti, one of the interesting things is that the old autocratic, caste-based kind of ideologies and systems became a limit on the kind of power and economic development that was driving the relations in Haiti. In other words, the slavery was vitally important to bring a massive wealth to Europe and develop the bourgeois project. And at the same time, it became a fetter on that production and that development. So it had to be negated in order to be realized in, you know, as a productive force. I know that sounds kind of maybe very immoral in a way to talk about it that way, or amoral, but that's me trying to summarize something that I read in C.L.R. James' book. He talked about this idea that the productive forces in Haiti were limited by the social relations that had taken hold of the people, even as those social relations had maybe produced, had created these productive forces. So I guess what I'm wondering is if that's something you took away from his work, and how you might think about that relationship between the social relations that we're trying to overcome and the productive forces that they produce.
Yeah. And you also have to look at how the various social classes that were within colonial Haiti at the time, because at the top,
right,
you had the Les Grands Blancs, the white plantation owners who were, of course, hostile to the revolutionary aims of even the French Revolution, and, you know, they were supportive of the Ancien Regime. Then you had the Petit Blanc, the sort of lower class whites who, I suppose, wanted to free themselves from the control of the Ancien Regime, but weren't so keen on extending it to sort of black people or people of color. And of course, you had the free men, people of color, the so-called mulattoes, who formed, you know, who wanted to challenge the racism, but only to the extent that it benefited them, but not, say, the slaves who were lower than them. Because and one part of C.L.R. James's book is it reveals the complete absurdity of racial classifications and, you know, any racial ideology, because there were so many sort of racial categories and the specific role they played in the class society, and it, you know, also just how absurd it was. Looking
when you were considered to be mulatto or a free man, but black is sort of how I'm thinking about this in Haiti. Were there privileges granted based on skin color in that realm that was not a full-on black slave, but free black man who, you know, I know there were lots of things that were restricted for the so-called mulattoes, but was there a gradation of privileges amongst those people in Haiti?
I think so, because I know some of them certainly owned like small plantations of their own, and they could have their own slaves and, you know, develop their own sort of plantation business, I suppose you could call it. I mean, even Toussaint Louverture, he was a privileged slave. He wasn't a mulatto, but he was fully black.
He was a free black man in Haiti, freed around at the age of 33 or something.
Yeah, and he had his own small coffee plantation with, this was before the revolution, and with some slaves of his own. So, because that was just the economy of that island. So, if you lived there, you were part of that mode of production, I suppose you could call it.
Right. And one of the things that was a fetter on the development of the Haitian economy was the fact that the mulatto class weren't given as much freedom, because they were actually some of the most productive bourgeois people on the island. They were less corrupted by the system. Mm-hmm. They were more likely to value education. From what I remember, they were just more successful in many ways as producers than a lot of the landed whites in Haiti.
But
because one of the reasons also is because they could talk and work with the black slaves, more efficiently as well, because they, you know, the tensions between the great whites and the black slaves were very obvious and direct, and with mulatto people, there was more feeling that there was a kinship between them, even if they did have that master slave relation.
Yeah, though after the revolution, that kinship begins to erode as the reality of class society becomes more real. As part of the reason why Haiti has experienced the problems it has is precisely because of this racial class hierarchies. So the mulattoes, generally speaking, have formed the political class, while the darker skinned blacks have been mostly at the bottom of the pile.
Right. Your essay is about how C.L.R. James rejected, the one at least I'm aware of, is about how he rejected identity politics. What was James's explanation for the historical emergence of anti-black racism as he saw it through maybe Haiti, but also overall?
Firstly, I would say that it came about through as a way to sort of rationalize slavery,
mm-hmm.
and to, you know, it's a simplistic slogan, but to divide the masses, you know, to keep them hostile to one another, to make them think that they have nothing in common with each other, or at least in terms of common interests.
Mm-hmm.
And also as a way to rationalize inequality that seems racial.
Yeah.
In
Haiti, the usual story about, you know, trying to keep the working classes divided may not work as much, because the fact is that the most of the workers were slaves in Haiti and they were black. But the way in which the whites would use anti-black racism to justify their claims to property and power, as they saw a threat emerging from the blacks, slaves, and the mulatto class, kind of informed my understanding of the way in which anti-black racism had a material foundation, but not one that you could say is simply like a matter of trying to get rich or even just trying to suppress the working classes, because it was bound up in racial categories. I mean, there was I know you understand this fully well, but I just wonder if you might help me out here in explaining what James's idea of a kind of a historical materialism was and how that influenced his interpretation of the events in Haiti.
Firstly, you have to rewind a bit and go back to the beginning, mm-hmm. which is the, you know, 1492, the discovery of the Americas by Columbus, mm-hmm. and Haiti was one of the first colonies to be, you know, established by Europeans, and it became treasured for, you know, crops such as sugar, tobacco, coffee, which, you know, this is the Eric Williams thesis that would help develop the growth of capitalism, the primitive accumulation
mm-hmm.
stage. This is and part of how that came about was, as Marx put it in Capital, the hunting for black skins, taking black slaves from Africa, transporting them through the Middle Passage and into the Americas so that they could, so that their labor could be exploited to pick this crop and ship it out. And then racism, or race, the idea of race, became as a way to, like I say, to basically justify and rationalize this enslavement of people who looked visibly different to white Europeans. And because it also came about with the ascendancy of Europe materially, from with the growth of capitalism, this grew, you know, various cultural and social ideas about, you know, white Europeans being superior to black people. And, you know, various, you know, a lot of, you know, Enlightenment philosophers believe this, like David Hume and Immanuel Kant, famously in his Anthropological Notes and stuff like that.
And today we have some critical theorists, or black critical theorists, who would argue that that maybe the idea of the black other was central to the European identity well before the emergence of capitalism, and that capitalism basically allowed these racist ideas to be actualized. But C.L.R. James certainly wouldn't be amongst those types of theorists who would want to claim that the racist attitudes were, are kind of built into the European identity.
Yeah, yeah, I disagree with those kinds of ideas, because I think they are a bit ahistorical, or they sort of interpret race in this kind of transhistorical state of being that is omnipotent, that has kind of a force of its own, that exists in a way outside of history altogether. And I personally, I think that's, first of all, anti-materialist and borderline taking a very you could say idealist way, interpretation right. of history, like very, like interpreting race in this sort of very spiritual way that has a power and force of its own that's outside the sort of agency of either human beings or of material forces.
But it seems as though, here's an interesting thing that I read, is that C.L.R. James has been sometimes incorporated into the kinds of cultural criticisms that would maybe halfway embrace more essentialist notions of race. Do you know how that has happened? Or, because I don't, this is like just an actual question. Do you know why it is that maybe like post-colonial theorists who might embrace a more idealist position, or post-modern thinkers would take up C.L.R. James as one of their own, even though he has such a kind of doctrinaire Marxist approach?
First of all, I think it's because, well, there are two things. One is the decline of Marxism as a serious sort of revolutionary ideology, and how it's almost become a sort of academic sort of fad. And that, I think, in a way, it's sort of C.L.R. James has been demarxified in this way. Secondly, I think a more noble interpretation is, the thing about C.L.R. James is that he was a very sort of orthodox Marxist, and he fully believed in all the precepts about class and materialism. And he even, I think there's a quote he once said that the class question takes precedent over the race question, which incidentally would be, would get him called a class, so-called class reductionist now.
Right.
but he also had a more, I suppose, not sure whether you can call this flexible or more creative approach than, say, the sort of stultifying, dogmatic Marxism that, say, came out of the Soviet Union at the time.
Right.
Where he could engage in questions of culture and sort of literature and even film and all these other, you could say, non-economic questions. And that allowed him to, I suppose, have a much more holistic view of things. And I think those theories sort of are sympathetic to it, but they sort of interpret it in a very one-sided manner. So you have the ideological and cultural critique, but without the materialist foundation that James built on.
Yeah. One of the ideas that he had that I think was a powerful one in the 60s was that rather than trying to build a vanguard party, we should look to the working class and certain elements of the working class to find our new vanguard movements. And that in the 50s and 60s, the Forrest Johnson tendency, that would be Raya Doyenskaya and C.L.R. James and a woman whose name is escaping me at the moment. But
Grace Lee Boggs,
right. They would put forward the idea that that there was a black vanguard in America because of the historical conditions, because of the conditions that the black workers found themselves in. They were the most likely to be driven to a socialist project, and if not a fully worked out socialist party that then the black workers would create, then at least the right kinds of decisions and questions would be emerging from the black struggles in America to create a black vanguard. I wonder, do you think that idea was correct at the time? And also, do you think that there's something to that idea that might still be worth exploring today, maybe in a world after the murder of George Floyd, or in America after the murder of George Floyd, anyhow? Go ahead.
At the time, I do think their position had a lot of weight and was, I think, could be reasonably justified, because you have to understand at the time, the position was formed in the 1940s, and this was still a time of Jim Crow, official legalized segregation, almost a semi-totalitarian police system against black Americans, mainly in the South, but there was an informal version of this in many parts of the North as well. And you had a large segment of the population that didn't have democratic rights. So, any talk of sort of class brotherhood or universal solidarity is a bit cheap and meaningless if, a sixth of the population, or a fifth, I should say, didn't have sort of equal democratic rights, even the most basic kind you'll find in any liberal democratic system. So I think their position was right at the time, and because of the fact that black Americans at the time were the super exploited part of the working class, that if you could mobilize them and in a way that struck at the foundations of that racist apartheid system, then the whole sort of society itself would shift. And I think you could say that their prediction was somewhat realized in the 1960s. As for now, I wouldn't, I, I, I wouldn't quite say so, because things have changed since the 1940s. I mean, Jim Crow doesn't exist in that way. There is a sort of, there's been a sort of double-sided notion to the integration of blacks within mainstream society. On the one hand, it's created sort of a black bourgeoisie or profession, PMC, whatever term you want to use. And at the same time, sort of a impoverished black working class or so-called underclass has been produced within this. So I think one reason I'm a bit skeptical of what C.L.R. James said in 1940 still applies now, is because you ignore it, sort of erases some of the nuances that have developed in the past few decades within how class and race have reconstituted themselves within American society. And say, take for example, and in some ways, that the over racialization of the discussion sort of blurs aspects of this debate. Like, take with the police brutality question, that obviously blacks are killed disproportionately, but then you also ignore how police generally police working class communities or communities across the United States, and the fact that a lot of white, mainly poorer people have been victims of police brutality as well. And I think this is where I think over racializing the discussion isn't really helpful and can produce needless antagonisms that don't need to be produced.
Mm-hmm. Although it's hard to say when you're over racializing the discussion, because there is a disparity in the United States between and also, if you go back to the 40s and 50s, there was also a struggle for democratic participation amongst whites then. I mean, as well, I mean, it's not as they had formal rights, but they didn't really have full participatory rights, or, you know, they weren't represented by the parties. By Marx's analysis, the workers have always been living within the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. So, you know, it's a problem to not just about race, but also about like the vision of what the steps are towards socialism. With the idea of the Black Vanguard that you expressed, that reminded me of something I read that C.L.R. James had written or spoken in the Soviet Union in the 60s. I believe this is the case, and where he was saying that the Vanguard Party was never the central tenet of Leninism, that the idea of the Vanguard Party was came up through the historical struggles in Russia, but that the aim of Leninism was always to expand the power of the working class, and to protect the gains of the working class, and that a parliamentarian path towards socialism was part of Lenin's conception of the socialist struggle before 1917, which would mean that, you know, the expansion of the expansion of who is enfranchised, it would be a key struggle for socialists to try to make sure everyone had those basic rights. The struggle for free expression, the right to free expression or right to assembly, would be, you know, central to the struggle for socialism, that, and the protection of bourgeois rights in general and the expansion of those rights would be considered to be important for socialist struggle. And the idea was that the more freedom workers had, the more ability they would have to become political, a political force for more radical transformation. And so yeah, so now when we think about police violence, we have to think about it in terms of what will get the police off the workers' backs. Like, who's going to lead the struggle to get rid of the violence of the police against the working class and that limits their ability to express their power and participate in the transformation of society, right?
And in fairness, too, because I know a lot of people have criticized the various protests and people have mocked sort of slogans like abolish the police, but even though the proposals is not quite as simplistic as the slogan professes that. But there has been, you know, a bit of a shift within which you would not have seen like 5 years ago, which is when the first round of Black Lives Matter protests came about. Like, for example, the fact that in Mississippi they even sort of debated the question of abolishing, you know, the police is very significant. And also, even I think I can't remember where this was proposed, but there was a proposal that of police not doing traffic stops at all, which is very, very significant. That would have been unthinkable, you know, even 2 years ago. So
right,
I do think, as for all the contradictions within the process, and there are parts of it I think can criticize, as you know, the debate of the past month has revealed, at the same time I do think there are openings which I think can be exploited in a good way.
I agree. I just the concerns I have around this particular struggle is that you know, I know some of the people involved in some parts of the country. Like, my own kids have been you know, involved in the Black Lives Matter movement in Eugene, and I hear about the kinds of debates that are going on, and I know people online, and it seems to me that what you hear anyway is in the expression of the need to abolish the police because the police are racist against people of color, and that in a society without the police, you know, people of color would be free from that violence. And that's where the whole analysis kind of tends to end. It's like, rather than, okay, so what are the material reasons for the police and what kind of power are Black people trying to achieve? And what do they want to do with that power? You know, those things aren't really discussed. The need for a transformation, that like the demand for abolishing the police is conceived of as the transformation rather than as a reform towards gaining something that could then be used for a transformation.
But then you could also say that for any meaningful reform to happen, you need a revolution or something like a revolutionary process for a reform, an actual reform to take place. Because this is, because you always get into this rather sterile debate of a reform versus revolution.
I'm not saying, I think the process will have to include reform, right? Mm-hmm. A revolutionary process will have to include struggles for reforms. It won't just be like tomorrow we're gonna, I mean, there was a dream for a moment while Trump was hiding in the bunker that we were just gonna walk into the White House, take it all apart, and, you know, there'd be a revolution right then and there on the spot. I knew people who like legitimately thought that was going to happen, but
you know, as Slavoj Žižek always makes this point that, mm-hmm. you know, what happens the day after you kick the president out and take over the White House? What happens the day after?
Right. Yeah. And that's like, when no one, yeah, you know, you invite a bunch of people in who smell like patchouli to sell some, I don't know, some handmade crafts, you know, on the White House lawn, and eventually the cops come in and clear you all out of there, I think is what happens. It's like the White House becomes a semi-autonomous zone for a couple weeks, maybe. Okay. Well, to bring it back to the Black Jacobins and C.L.R. James, and to kind of remain in this moment where we're trying to think about socialist struggle, one of the things that's interesting about the Black Jacobins is that James revised it in maybe two different ways. I think he issued a second edition with an appendix and some alterations in the 60s. And then also he wrote a play called The Black Jacobins.
Yeah.
And in the play specifically, he changed his focus. To the slaves and other kind of less known figures in Haiti, because he was trying to break from a vanguardist ideology. What do you think about that move and that attempt to reinterpret the Haitian Revolution that he underwent?
I've seen sort of more, if you call left comms, sort of give that sort of, yeah, I suppose you could say proto-autonomist interpretation of the Haitian Revolution. And look, I can understand why he would make that sort of move, because it's funny, because the first appendix, the second one you're talking about in the 1960s, he wrote that appendix and it talks about Fidel Castro, and he's making a parallel between Fidel and Toussaint Louverture as two sort of anti-colonial leaders of their nation expelling imperialist powers for the national autonomy of their people and the nation. And then obviously the play, or the sort of latest reinterpretation, takes this sort of proto-autonomous sort of anti-hierarchies, sort of very focused on the masses and their agency. Because what you have to understand about C.L.R. James, he was a radical Democrat.
Right.
Do you know the phrase, every cook can govern, which actually comes from Lenin, from state and revolution. And that's, I think that's the part of Lenin he really, really likes, that the libertarian Lenin in state and revolution. And he sort of really believed in the agency of ordinary human beings to alter their own destiny and transform the world. And I think there's a lot of value in that. I do think even a lot of the modern left sort of underappreciates. But I think, I suppose you could say that where on two grounds, C.L.R. James is a bit, flawed in his, first of all, the dialectic between human agency and, various material forces that, as I said before, either enhance or constrain that agency, how they both interact with one another, and how I think you can't, in any sort of process, you do need some kind of broad structure, which maybe you could call it the vanguard party, or you could call it something else, but I don't think you can, any sort of pure autonomous, just movementist sort of dynamic can be enough to, you have to sort of shape it and direct it in some way. Now, and obviously I understand the authoritarianism that was associated with Leninist vanguardist party. And as well, in the history of revolutions, there is, an interesting history between sort of people, the divide between people who become the new elites and then the masses. Mm-hmm. Like you saw this, ever since Oliver Cromwell, you've had this. Even the Haitian Revolution, you even saw it a little bit with Toussaint Louverture. He did have a bit of an authoritarian streak in him. And of course, Dessalines, who came after him, was, a kind of very Bonapartist figure himself, like he declared himself the emperor of Haiti and all this. Right. So I think he was trying to find a way to get away from that whole dynamic.
Right.
Sort of, or the authoritarian personality always seems to win out and dominate and distort the original revolutionary aims of the movement.
So I'm going to ask you to channel CLR James if you can. I know that that's a very tall order, but can you imagine if CLR James was alive today and looking at the current activities on the left and the current situation that we're in, what he would be advocating for and what he might be criticizing? I mean, I imagine you're going to just probably say, well, he would be advocating for the things I advocate for and criticizing the things I criticize. Just like every Marxist would say, you know, Marx would be advocating for what I think and critiquing what I dislike. But I'll give you a chance to pretend that you're CLR James. So what do you think?
Well, you know, it's funny because it's been 31 years since he died. Christopher Hitchens once, he was asked a similar question about George Orwell. Like, what would Orwell say if he lived now? And he said, well, you could sort of do that for the first couple of decades after his death. But anymore, you're in very uncharted territory. But with CLR, I think I can get away with it. I think if he was alive today, I think he would implore the left to try and rediscover its original aims, sentiments, and what its own ideals, and then go from there. Like, for example, the point about human agency, the fundamentally revolution is about the masses, or, you know, people changing, altering, and transforming their destiny. You know, because which is one of the most valuable gains of the Enlightenment and the Age of Revolution of the 18th century. Because before then, human beings were seen as the objects of history, not the subjects. So I think CLR James will be advocating for that radical sense of human agency in accordance to radical democracy. So every person has the ability to shape and alter and have a say in governance and the regime of the state. And I think he would also, obviously, because I'm saying this because I say it as well, but I think I've got good, I'm on firm ground in saying this, that he would also be warning against sort of growing identity essentialism that's going on among the left, and he would implore people to rediscover class sort of solidarity and an idea of analyzing how class shapes race and also vice versa, so that you could have a revolutionary movement that can transcend class society altogether, and you have freedom actually comes into being. Because I think because CLR James was also a very Hegelian Marxist, because he wrote an entire book on Hegel, and one of the lessons one, I guess, would learn from Hegel is that modernity makes freedom possible, but it's not guaranteed. And it's up to us to guarantee it.